Hello, welcome back to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. My guest today is David Moser, an associate professor at Beijing Capital Normal University. He's had a fascinating and varied career in academia, teaching courses in Chinese history and politics, and authoring books on Mandarin grammar and the unification of the Chinese language, among other things. There's so much we could have spoken to David about, but for this interview, we decided to focus on two main areas. The first is his story of self-studying Chinese to fluency. It began in the US in the 1980s and ultimately led to a series of amazing life experiences in Beijing, where he became a national star, performing in front of up to a billion people in live televised comedy sketches. The second point of focus of this interview is a piece David wrote called Why Chinese is So Damn Hard. It's possibly the most widely read blog post on Chinese learning ever written, and also one of the inspirations for me starting my own blog and this podcast. The post is a tongue-in-cheek lament on the difficulties and frustrations we all face when we take on the Chinese language. I've included a link in the description if you're interested in checking it out, and definitely recommend doing that. I hope to have the opportunity to get David back on the podcast to discuss his academic career in the future, but for now, I give you round one of my interview with David Moser. Okay, so David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's a great honor. I've seen some of the guests you've had on, quite stellar. I'm happy to be a part of this podcast.
I wanted to start by going back to the 1980s and 1987 in particular, which was when you, I believe, first moved to Beijing and started working at Peking University. Did you know any Chinese back then, or had you been studying Chinese before then, or what was the situation?
Right. I have a very unique first experience with Chinese. All I can say is, you know, at the time, 1984, 85, I was working on a master's in music at Indiana University. But for some reason, I had also been very obsessed with learning languages. And I taught myself French with the dictionary and some books and went to Paris a couple times and could speak fairly good French. It was not that hard since it has so much borrowed vocabulary. But for some reason, I just got fascinated with and obsessed with Chinese. I think because my sister had been to Taiwan and had a Taiwanese boyfriend, and somehow just talking with him and also some other Taiwanese women that I knew, I just got very interested in Chinese and started teaching myself. So I'm actually virtually all self-taught in Chinese. I use the De Francis books. I don't know if you know, there's early John De Francis Chinese learning textbooks. Did you ever see those?
Never heard of them.
Okay. Well, they're antiques. You could probably get them on you know, Taobao or one of the... Anyway, yeah. And so I was able to speak some basic Chinese, and I did it merely by meeting Chinese people, whether it be in a Chinese restaurant or some of the my classmates who were from either Taiwan or Hong Kong or mainland China, and practiced writing characters. I was absolutely obsessed with characters. I thought they were beautiful. And I had no goal and no point to what I was doing. It just was a sort of one of those hobbies that just was, found it very enjoyable and intellectually stimulating. But then it turns out that I did have a goal or a reason, unbeknownst to me, and that is that there was a famous book that was written by a man named Douglas Hofstadter called Gödel, Escher, Bach, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. It was one of the first books about artificial intelligence, and Doug was a friend of mine at Indiana University, and he found out that Peking University had a translation team that was beginning to translate his book into Chinese. And he said to me, I know you're learning Chinese. I know you're not fluent yet, but I'm going to send you to Beijing and have you take part in the translation team and make sure they don't mistranslate or completely botch my book. And he didn't have to ask me twice. I said, okay. And that's so I ended up spending four years in Beijing at Peking University on a translation team, helping to translate that very long and complicated book, which was difficult because they didn't have word processors back then. So I had to read handwritten Chinese. The manuscripts were all in handwritten Chinese. And that was my beginning experience with the Chinese language.
That's amazing. And just to dwell a little more on the fact that you were initially totally self-taught. I mean, this is something that I've covered on this podcast, that it's increasingly common that more and more people because of the benefits of technology, are teaching themselves Chinese. And I'm an example of that, and several people I've interviewed on this podcast are examples of that. But I haven't actually come across very many examples of people who were entirely self-taught back then, like in the before the internet, before anything like that. So that must have, you must have been, that was quite rare. Or did you know other people who had adopted a similar hobby?
No, it was quite rare. In fact, kind of insane, a bit foolhardy to even try that. But you know something, I think I had just an instinct for that. I mean, you're right. Back then, there was no internet really, and all the Chinese language instruction books were incredibly boring and dull. And also, I very quickly realized that Chinese, because I had for comparison, I had learning French, which was actually kind of a breeze because, you know, very quickly I could get some pretty sophisticated vocabulary. And I realized that Chinese was a different animal completely. And in order to do well and master it, I would have to sort of develop my own curriculum. You know, I had to figure out what I needed to say and what I wanted to say. And I think that's probably why I was able to make more progress, because I didn't take a structured class. I just tried to learn, you know, what I needed to learn and what I wanted to say. So, and then once I was involved in this book, of course, I was forced to learn a lot very quickly. But I think I did a smart thing, which was just to meet Chinese people, invite them out to dinner, and say, can I talk to you and can I record our conversation? That became my Chinese learning materials, was just handmade, self-studied materials.
Mm, that's amazing. Yeah. So you would record the conversations, and then you'd go back and listen to them and kind of analyze the way they were kind of putting sentences together and try and imitate that. Would that be right?
Yeah. Or very often I would just ask them outright, you know, how do I say, you know, is the meal delicious or something, you know, and they would tell me. But back then I was kind of unaware of an important aspect though, which is I didn't really realize that there were so many different Chinese accents. And so I would say, how come this guy says 是不是 and this guy says 是不是? I mean, I was very confused, and I've slowly caught on that, you know, you can't trust that the accent you're hearing is standard Mandarin. And so I soon became aware of that and how to conquer that problem.
Back then, in terms of pronunciation and tones, was that something that you found particularly challenging in terms of actually producing it yourself, like particularly the tones? How did you go about that when you were self-studying in those initial years?
I think I had a slight advantage. This might be a little controversial, but some people say if you're a musician or you have a musical ear, that I don't know, how do you feel about that? Do you think that's true, that people with a musical ear can hear the tones better? I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, it's probably true. I just always found it very annoying when people said that, just because especially when I was struggling with tones, it's not an advantage I had. So when people would say that they had an advantage because of that, people who were good at tones, I'd always ask them, like, how do you get good at tones? And more often than not, they would reply with that. And then I'd say, well, there's not very much I can do with that. So I kind of hope it's not true. It seems like it probably is true, because, I mean, at least anecdotally, I've heard this from so many people.
Yeah, I kind of think that, because I never really had too much problem producing the tones when people would give me the model. Sometimes I had a very difficult time distinguishing second and third tones when spoken, when listening. But I didn't really have that much trouble with tones, and I saw my fellow students sometimes hopelessly lost, and they couldn't even hear the distinctions. So yeah, tones wasn't a problem, but vocabulary was. And I found extremely frustrating. I mean, for years, I mean, I almost gave up many times, because it's really one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do. So, but tones wasn't really the problem, although I still make tone mistakes all the time. But it wasn't a problem in learning. I had other problems. The problem was reading and the script, which we can get into later, I suppose, but not tones.
Kind of related to all of the challenges that you've just mentioned, you wrote this famous blog, which is called Why Chinese is So Damn Hard. I remember reading that blog for the first time several years ago when I was struggling with Chinese, a kind of beginner level. So, but there's no kind of date on that blog. So I'm first of all wondering, when was that blog written? Was that kind of written around the time when you were self-studying, like in those initial years or subsequently after that? Or?
It was written after I'd sort of finished my duties at Peking University translating the book. I wrote it in 1991 or 92 as part of a kind of, I was working at a cognitive science research group at Indiana University, and I think I wrote it as a special paper for that. The impetus for it was, I would say, John DeFrancis and Victor Mayer. John DeFrancis is well worth investigating because he was a linguist and a historian at the University of Hawaii and wrote several wonderful books on the origins of the national language. And also he wrote a book called The Chinese Language, Fact and Fantasy, which if you haven't read that book, I recommend it to anyone. It's still quite relevant. It covers all the issues that I covered in that short paper, but also, you know, the problems of learning Chinese and the problems of promulgating the language through education to the masses. But it was John DeFrancis and also Victor Mayer, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who has always been a strong advocate of what he would call bigraphia, I can't remember which one, which is sort of, he was a strong advocate of learners using both pinyin and Chinese characters in tandem. Even in daily life, you know, I think it would be very possible to use pinyin even back then. And those were sort of my mentors. I mean, by that time, I had already made contacts with Victor Mayer, and he was a great help to me in writing my PhD thesis. So I basically wrote that as kind of a joke. No, not kind of a joke, but really a joke. But I really meant it as a kind of a way of commiserating with all of the people that I knew who were learning Chinese and having the same struggles that I had. So it was kind of a complaint, a long kind of sort of sad lament that how incredibly hard this language is and why exactly it was hard. And it turns out, you know, I think many hundreds of thousands of people have read this by now, and the people that know me from that article, they say the same thing. They say, oh, I was so disappointed and heartbroken that of my Chinese progress. And then I read your article and I realized it wasn't only my problem. Everyone else was having the same problem, right? But things are so much easier now than they were then that I would change the title. The title was Why is Chinese So Damn Hard? I think I would change the title now to Why is Chinese So Darn Hard? It's no longer damn hard. It's just darn hard.
So darn is like, because in British English, I'm not sure that we have the same distinction. So darn is like less.
Yeah, maybe
emphatic.
Maybe the original would be bloody. Why is Chinese so bloody hard? Or maybe is how strong bloody is. Is bloody very strong or very weak? I'm not sure.
Bloody is used when you don't want to swear.
Yeah, right. Okay. Oh, then that's perfect. No, so the original version would be, why is Chinese so, and then the F word, so effing hard. And now I would change it to, why is Chinese so bloody hard?
Well, that was actually the next question I was going to ask you, because reading through the blog, there were a lot of things that I think learners today would identify with most of it. But I was going to ask you, do you think, since this blog was written in the early 1990s, that since then the way that Chinese is learned has just totally changed? And like you just alluded to there, it's become a lot easier in various ways because of access to resources, because of, you know, software that makes it easier, particularly like spaced repetition software and things like that. I guess it's changed a lot since you wrote that blog.
Yes, absolutely. I think probably the biggest revolution, the digital revolution, was the Pleco dictionary and similar kinds of dictionaries or devices that enable you to instantly get the tone and the definition of anything that's on the screen. I would have, you know, pushed my own mother off a cliff back then if I could have had a great tool like that, because it's so valuable, you know. I think that's one of the reasons why young people nowadays are able to learn Chinese so much quicker. First, they have lots of good, you know, translation devices, but there's so many devices, you know, if you digitize it, you can zoom through, you know, a text pretty much as you would a quote-unquote normal language without having to look up every single word. I actually went through an entire book, a novel by an author named Qian Zhongshu called Wei Cheng, Fortress Besieged. And it was a wonderful, funny novel. And I wanted to read it all the way through and get, you know, savor every, all the idioms and all the wonderful examples of language. So I actually went through the entire book and wrote down in pencil every single character or word that I didn't understand. And I would wrote the pinyin and then the definition through the whole, entire book. And it took me like 6 months just to read the book doing that. And nowadays I look back on that. I still have a copy of that book that I, you know, notated and annotated. And I realized, oh my God, I was inventing Pleco. That's what I was trying to do. And it was, I was just 20 years to, you know, before that. Oh man, I just, when I said, God, this is what I'd been hoping for my whole life. And there it was, right? So yeah, I think definitely the Chinese language tools that you had to work with were definitely a godsend. Back then, you know, we were still looking up every character using the radical component method, which, you know, it could take you 3 or 4 minutes just to look up one character. So yeah, it saved a lot of time.
Well, and also I'm just thinking that back then there was, if you wanted to learn to write Chinese, there was really no choice. You had to be able to write Chinese by hand. Whereas nowadays you can rely on pinyin to type, to text people. This is how most native speakers text each other now and type. And you just select the character, so your only task is to be able to recognize it visually. So people who are learning Chinese now have a choice. They can prioritize other aspects and not learn to write out by hand, but still be able to communicate through the written word. Whereas back then you didn't have that choice.
Quite correct. That's right. Yeah. For a long time, you know, I've been noticing this, it's in my article, of course, but just this problem of TB, Wang Zi, right? That the lift up the pen and you forget the character, right? So I, even back then, I think that the anecdote I tell in my article is meeting with 3 PhD students at Peking University, Chinese students, one from Hong Kong, and I just asked them how they write the word sneeze in Chinese, da pen ti, the character ti, and none of them could write it. And I thought, my God, here are 3 Chinese natives who can't write the word sneeze in their own language. And I realized that it's not just a foreigner's problem of learning Chinese. The Chinese themselves are forgetting the characters, especially ones that, you know, that aren't part of the normal sorts of newspaper Chinese, the more colloquial or spoken Chinese. But so, yeah, that's a huge problem. This might be a subject for another podcast, or some of you might want to get on the podcast, but there is a movement now on the part of many, many Chinese educators to drastically change the way that we learn Chinese in the schools. The person who's spearheading that movement is a man named Matt Koss, C-O-S-S, Matt Koss, who is brought together a group of teachers, pedagogy experts, and totally redoing the way that we teach Chinese characters.
But is this teaching Chinese characters to native speakers or
foreigners,
to foreigners?
To foreigners especially. But right. However, this is happening at a different level in the schools in Beijing and in China. They are relaxing the requirements of the students to be able to write every character that they've learned. And they're even allowing second, third graders and fourth graders, if they write an essay, they're allowed to use pinyin occasionally if they can't remember how to write the character, because they don't want to disrupt the flow of thought as the child is trying to write. So, yeah, a change is afoot, is happening now. And one of the big things is, as you said, you just said it actually, the skill that's required now for Chinese characters is really the reading them, not writing them, because writing is not important now. I don't write by hand in English anymore. So the task is, how many characters can you recognize and say out loud with the correct tone, not how many characters can you write down on the page.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, I know that there's a lot of schools that still persist in enforcing this kind of rigid adherence to just insisting that all foreigners must learn to write out every character by hand. Personally, like, I would prefer it if, like, we moved away from that, just because most foreigners there who learn Chinese there, that their goals are not aligned with that. They want to learn Chinese to be able to communicate. And so, although there's an argument in terms of preservation of culture, this is sort of like not why most foreigners get into
That's
learning
right.
Chinese.
That's
so I don't know how you feel about that. Is it?
Yeah.
If you agree
no,
with
I
that?
No, I think I agree. I mean, it's a trade-off. In no other language do you have to make that trade-off. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say, well, I want to learn French, but I don't want to learn how to write it. That's ridiculous because the writing is simple. It's just a matter of the notating the sounds of the speech. But because the Chinese system is so completely different, you really have to make a choice. Do I want to spend all my time writing characters, which, you know, even Chinese are not able to do now? Or do I want to spend my time reading and especially speaking? The famous French linguist Saussure, you know, said the core of language is speaking and listening, and the writing and reading are a secondary. They're adjunct skills. And I think, you know, the Chinese pedagogy for so long was based upon a kind of mistaken notion that if you didn't know how to write the character, you wouldn't recognize it. And that's just totally wrong. You know, I can probably recognize, I don't know, last time I tested, maybe something like 3,500 characters. But I certainly cannot write 3,500 characters. No way. I mean, the highest I ever reached was maybe something like 2,000 or 1,500. And now I don't think I can even write 500 reliably nowadays. So, I mean, yeah, the speech, the core of language is speaking. I mean, come on. We had students, you know, that I had in my classes and things who, not my classes, but I mean, who had been taking, you know, Chinese courses for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and they couldn't say anything because they were spending all their time, you know, doing tingxie and, you know, other kinds of things. So, yeah, it's a great new age, and the digital age has allowed us to do what we should be doing all along, which is concentrating on speaking and listening and not writing.
Right, yeah. And something else you mentioned there is another argument in favor of not writing characters out by hand, which is that I've heard this from several people who learned Chinese at a time when they didn't have a choice. Steve Kaufman is another example. And he will say now that, you know, of the thousands of characters that he learned to write out by hand at that time when there was no choice, he can maybe remember a couple of hundred, even if that, now. Whereas I think it's a lot easier to maintain the spoken language. I mean, you can kind of speak Chinese at any time if you have people around you who are willing to do that with you. But like with to maintain the ability to write out by hand is a lot more difficult. I wanted to move on to talking about your career in TV, in Chinese TV, because this was another interesting aspect of what you were doing in China shortly after you moved there in the 80s, and you pursued a career in academia throughout the 90s. And then during that period as well, you started getting involved in hosting and producing Chinese TV shows. Is that right?
Well, I started out doing this Chinese form of comedy called xiangsheng, which is usually in English crosstalk. You may have heard this famous Canadian Chinese speaker, Da Shan, Mark Rosewell. So he was one of the first ones to go on TV doing this crosstalk comedy. It's usually a two people, a straight man and a funny man, you know. And I actually got into that when I was at Peking University translating this book because I was so frustrated with, you know, any kinds of Chinese teaching materials that I could get my hands on. I said, this is also boring and unrealistic. And somebody said, well, just study xiangsheng. It's this, you know, it's funny. It has history. It has music. It has literature. It has dialects, jokes, puns. So I said, oh, great. So I started doing that. And I took a xiangsheng master named Ding Guangquan, who took me on as a disciple. And I started doing these skits on TV. And that was the main thing I started doing. I would say back then I was probably in the top 5% or even 3% of foreign Chinese speakers. Nowadays, I think I'm like in the top 50%, maybe. Certainly not the top 2 or 3. There's many, many young people your age or younger that speak very, very good Chinese now. And then I began to do, not producing, but I was on Channel 10, which is the education channel, and it was an English teaching channel, but we did lots of English skits and plays. And then nowadays I do news shows, talk shows, or different kinds of things. So, yeah, I've been on TV for a long time. But back then it was the fun thing of doing these, they call them xiaopian, these skits. I did a few of those. And those were fun. Those were great. And it was great exercise, too, because when you learn a skit, you have to really memorize your lines very fluently. And so you find that if you do that, you can actually use some of those lines in daily life. And it really helps you to build some, not just words and words, but also phrases and even entire sentences. So, yeah, that was my experience with TV.
I remember a few years ago, I was like looking at videos of Dashan, who's like you just mentioned. I think his name is Mark Roswell, and he's probably the most famous Chinese speaking foreigner in the history of modern history. For a certain generation, he's sort of the gold standard. That's right. If you go to China, then you'll have your Chinese level always will be compared to him for like sort of anyone who's over the age of 50 or so.
Right.
But I remember watching a video of Dashan, who was doing a performance at some kind of New Year gala. And I'd previously come across your work in various forms, initially through the blog that we've just talked about. And I'd seen pictures of you online, but associated with other work that you'd done. And I was watching this performance and I was thinking, Is that the same guy? And it turns out like it was actually you, but like I kind of couldn't draw the connection because I didn't know that you had that background in doing those performances. But this one was at a New Year's kind of gala, which would have been broadcast, I imagine, to millions and millions of Chinese people. You were kind of a bunch of about five foreigners on stage who were performing some skit. Did you get recognized then when you were in China? Did you become a minor celebrity or a major one?
Oh, sure. No, yeah. I mean, it was not just millions, but by the time the Chinese diaspora had seen it overseas, you know, that probably as many as a billion people watched that. That's what they sometimes say. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh my God, you can't imagine. You know, the very next day, you know, out on the street, everyone, you know, was recognizing me, and of course, Dashan was already quite famous. But I have to say that actually that skit, to tell the truth, was not very funny. And the reason was that it started out funny, but every time we had to go through we went through a sort of a vetting process where some people, including the censors, would watch it, and they would say, okay, you can't say that, you got to take this out. And then they changed every time we went through a tryout. They said, okay, you can't do that, you know, change that, switch it around. And so by the time we got to the final version, it had been so sort of sliced and diced, and all of the funny parts had gone on the floor, and there was nothing left funny in the skit. And so what I got mostly the next day or the few days after that was they say, hey, I saw you on TV last night. Wow, good for you. That was the worst act in the whole play, in the whole performance. They always said your act was the lamest. I thought so. It was a bittersweet. You know, we were sort of glad to do it, but it was not very funny. And they asked us to do it again for the next year, and we all refused. We said nope, because it takes all your time. I mean, like a month, you have to spend half your time at the TV studio. So no, we just said no. It's not worth it. But it was great. It was fun. It was pretty good.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that I've heard you say as well is that all the preparation over the years that you put into taking part in these shows and speaking Chinese in front of an audience so that you know you have to get it right, that this really helped in terms of your spoken Chinese in general. And I think that that makes a lot of sense in terms of my own experience and what other people have said, that kind of in language learning in general, this kind of anything that has to do with rote learning, memorizing, listen, repeat, has kind of gone out of fashion a little bit. But I think particularly for Chinese, in terms of the muscle memory challenges involved, it's particularly effective.
Oh, you say a good word there, muscle memory. I think that's really very insightful. That's exactly the problem, is muscle memory. You can say something, but can you really say it? Can you really express it with all the intonations? Yeah, I think that's a huge point. So I think that the learning lines from a play, just like you would just for any, a performance, is really very good because those lines can become part of your daily speech. And you said muscle memory. Yes, that's exactly right. If you can say something grammatically correct, even with correct tones, but it doesn't sound like that you're really speaking because, you don't feel like it's you. I actually have been coaching some Chinese speaker, some Chinese students at my university on English. You know, they will say something correctly, and I will say, "All right, now say it as if you really mean it." And they don't really know what I'm talking about. And then I say, "You've got to put body language into it." So I remember just the other day the phrase that she was saying was, "Oh my God, that's the worst mistake I ever made." And of course she was saying, "Oh my God, that's the most worst mistake I have ever made." I said, "All right, now say it. Say, oh my God, that's the worst mistake I've ever made." And I finally got her to do it a little bit. I said, "All right, now use your hands. You're standing like you're paralyzed. Use your hands. Use your face." And I finally got her to do it. I think they got the idea. That's speaking. If you're just saying things, and the only way you can do that is you have enough sort of words and fixed phrases that you can use, string them together and make it, you know, really fluent and effective. That's the last stage you have to go through, and I think that's really important. A lot of people never really reach that stage, but you really have to practice saying things, you know, and putting emotion into them. And yeah, muscle memory is part of that.
Well, that reminds me of another thing that you mentioned, going back to the blog that we were discussing earlier about how Chinese is so damn hard, which was that you were talking about how the importance of intonation, whole sentence intonation in Chinese, and how difficult this is because it's entirely different from English intonation at the whole sentence level. And it's kind of, English intonation is governed by like mood, and kind of like if you're angry, you'll tend to stress words and pronounce them with kind of a fourth tone. Whereas in Chinese, it's governed by both emotion, and also you have the tone system, which acts as what you call a straitjacket. And I thought that was very insightful. But I actually thought that this makes, like, in some ways, this is an advantage of Chinese that makes it easier. Because one problem that a lot of people have, which you allude to in this blog, is that they end up bringing in their, like, native language emotion into pronouncing a Chinese sentence. And they end up, like, so they end up making, like, tone mistakes and kind of intonation mistakes because of that. Because if they're saying something angrily, they'll pronounce a third tone, something that should have been a third tone, as a fourth tone, etc. Whereas when you kind of apply the straitjacket of tones, it now makes it impossible for you to bring in your native language intonation. So although, like, you then have the added challenge then of adding kind of the Chinese intonation, at least it kind of gets rid of your native language influence in that way. That was kind of my experience.
Yeah, no, that's very good. That is very important. You know, the basic principle is the same, is that in both languages we have intonation patterns, you know, that cause, you know, contrast or stress and so forth. And when you get angry or put more emotion, that what happens is those stress points become even greater stressed even more, or deeper or higher, right? And that's the same thing with Chinese, that you stress the tone, not the well, the example I give is something like, you know, people say, "这不是你的笔，这是我的笔."
Yeah, that's
right.
Brilliant one, yeah.
that's the problem. You want to say, "This isn't your pen. This is my pen," and you say, "What a bee!" Right. So the same thing is true in English. In Chinese, of course, but you just you stress the tone. So if you are just casually asking, "What's this all about?" you say, "什么事儿啊?" But if you're mad at someone and you said, "这是什么事儿啊?" right? So it becomes, it's the same thing. So it's the same principle, but you're right. You have to just sort of interiorize the tones, you know, so that when you want to stress something, you just naturally stress that particular tone and not just going out of habit just by, you know, always putting fourth tone. We don't think it's fourth tone in English. We just think it's stress, but it's actually fourth tone. And also, you know, there are things, interesting things about British and American English. You know, people say, well, the rising question intonation for English, you know, like, "Is this yours?" You know, this rising thing. But if you look at British English, if Americans will say, "Would you like some tea?" and which is second tone, tea. But the British will say, "Would you care for some tea?" which is third tone, right? So occasionally the British will use third tone. So, I mean, the tones are sort of there in the languages. You know, I mean, there are certain tonal patterns that we all use. So the question is just, you know, how do you put stress on top of those patterns? You know, learn whether Chinese learn British or American English, they have to learn two different kinds of tonal systems in it, or stress systems, actually. It's a real fascinating kind of domain to study.
Okay, well, fantastic. Well, that's been super insightful to talk to you all about your experiences learning Chinese. And we haven't had a chance to go into in more depth all your really interesting career in academia, which hopefully at some point in future we'll have another chance to talk more about that. That's for a separate podcast. But once again, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and for sharing all that insight and experience with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. I look forward to talking with you again. Thanks.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter, run by me and my friend Will Hart. We share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.